So what most people do, unless you're a masochist, is you quit, you give up, you focus on your kids and your family, and you go do something different.
But so you're a masochist.
Yes. That's a good question.
Yes. Maybe. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Waxcast, episode 37. Today I'm joined by a muckraker, a guerrilla journalist, a leprechaun, and a good friend of mine, Mr. James O'Keefe. James, thank you for coming.
Great to be here.
So I want to talk about, you know, obviously Project Veritas, all the work you guys have been doing over the last year has been insane, probably one of the best years on record, maybe in terms of what you guys have been delving into. But first I want to go straight into what they're doing to suppress your efforts. You know, you're going up against big tech, big media, all these sort of monopolistic forces. And, you know, we all grew up in school learning about, you know, Upton Sinclair and, you know, the original progressive era, you know, journalists, you know, with the meatpacking industry, right, which seems very novel compared to what you're doing today. But they're all, you know, heralded as these great champions of journalism. And they're saying, these are the people you have to look up to. These are great individuals who fought for American values, who upheld the free press. But then you and your rag team of journalists are demeaned as not credible and not serious, and you're, you know, defamed left and right. Why is there such a double standard compared to the work that you guys are doing today, which is of greater importance in my mind, compared to the progressive era journalists of old?
Well, how much time do we have?
Well, we have as much time as you want.
That is a very important question. Upton Sinclair, you know, we read about him in our history books when we were young. 1906, he wrote The Jungle.
Yep.
And Upton Sinclair never intended, I don't think his intent was to expose the conditions of the rotting meat. He was a socialist, yep, an avowed socialist who had an agenda. Mm-hmm. He wanted to advance socialism. And if you read the biographies of Upton Sinclair, he did sort of go undercover. He had a lunch pail and took off his tie and tried to fit in, tried to assimilate with the workers in the condition of the factory. And then he ran back to his hotel room and scribbled down what he saw. And I think the quote is, he intended to get people in the head, but he got them in the stomach with his work. And then you had reporters like Gunter Wallraff, who's one of the guys I cite frequently. He was a German undercover reporter also.
In the newspaper.
He got a job working at the Bild, which is Germany's largest newspaper, and he went undercover as a reporter. So he actually got a job as a reporter in order to document what he thought is they wanted to strike, worker strike. And a lot of Pam Zekman of Chicago Sun-Times, William Gaines posts as a janitor for the Chicago Sun-Times in 1972. They won Pulitzer Prizes at the Chicago Sun-Times in the early 1970s. Something changed in the late 1970s. Ben Bradley of the Washington Post said, no more Pulitzers for you if you use pretense to get a story. And once the trophies stopped coming, once you stopped getting a medal for doing this, then journalists stopped doing
it. The institutional respect.
Correct. And that's really what this is about. That's my hypothesis. And I think they stopped doing it. This is 1977. They stopped doing this undercover work. And the problem I have in journalism is that if you stop using these techniques, if you stop using whistleblowers and you stop using undercover work to get the truth, you tend to believe what sources tell you, which is corrupting in journalism, because the traditional way of talking, where you talk to a anonymous source, you don't know what this person is saying. We don't know the motives for what they've said.
The bias.
It's basically a bona fide press conference. Yeah. when a source, you know, and the Washington Post officials briefed on the matter.
Who are just these stenographers? People? They're just regurgitating a press release and calling it journalism.
And we don't know what these people actually said. We don't know whether what they said is true. So, and then, in addition to that change in the late 70s, early 80s, now you just have this sort of brave new world where facts no longer matter. Our world has become so polarized. You know, whether that's Huxley or Orwell, a combination of both, this 1984 thing where, you know, people, facts just no longer matter. And it's becoming a
newspeak.
Newspeak and doublethink, as Orwell called it, to believe that black is white and then a moment later to believe that black is black. It's just utter insanity.
We've always been at war with East Asia.
Right? The Emmanuel Goldstein.
Yep.
Everyone needs to go back to that chapter where the Emmanuel Goldstein oligopoly or theory of collectible oligarchy, it reads like present day.
The best thing I ever learned in school was when I was in school suspension, I read 1984. It was actually good. I got out of classrooms, read 1984. That actually opened my eyes. That was a red pill moment. But you touched on a few things that's wrong with the institution of journalism. I think a lot of people have also harped on the fact that it seems that journalism has gone from a profession that was really from, you know, working class people, you know, to make their bones on the beat. And now it's sort of become the playground of the children of wealth. You know, you have wealthy kids, they go to, you know, expensive liberal arts schools and they pretend to be journalists, and they get these very fancy jobs and titles at the Washington Post or whatever, and it's all prestige, but they're not actually doing real journalism. And then they stick their nose up at people, independent journalists, alternative news sources that are actually getting out there on the field doing things while they're just, you know, reprinting AP articles and adding their own slant to it. I mean, what's wrong with what PV does? You guys go out, you use disguises, you do guerrilla tactics, but that's how you get to the bottom of things. What's wrong with that?
I mean, nothing traditionally was wrong with it. You know, Jacob Bagage of the Washington Post, there's this amazing moment on CNN where he's attacking me and attacking Veritas for working with the mailman whistleblower. And he goes, well, credible journalist. And the way he says it, it's so condescending. Well, they're not credible. They're relying upon these folks are relying upon, I guess, a brand that they don't even have. Like they're you know, there's a guy at NYU who's a journalism professor. What's his name? I can't recall his name, but he's a professor of journalism at NYU. And he says, every time you rely upon an anonymous source, it's like going to the ATM and doing a bank withdrawal. You're withdrawing currency on your own credibility.
Is that Rechtenwald?
Wasn't it Rechtenwald? I'll come to me in a minute. And he's you're taking a withdrawal against your own credibility. You have to sometimes deposit into a bank account in order to make a withdrawal. And increasingly, journalists just keep asking us to rely upon the fact that they're credible.
Right.
They're not giving us any reason for us to believe that they're credible.
Right.
Whereas Veritas, we don't report anything unless you can hear it for yourself. Hmm. And how fascinating would it be if we could actually interview these anonymous sources? And Bob Woodward wrote a book called Fear about President Trump. And in the first, one of the first pages, it said, all these interviews are conducted on background. What does that mean to those of you who are not inside, you know, politicos? It means that Bob goes to, you know, someone's house at midnight, interviews him all night, and then that guy is telling Bob Woodward a story about something he overheard in the White House from 1 or 2 years previous, and then Woodward recreates that scene, told on hearsay, puts it in quotes.
That would never be acceptable in a court of law.
Can you imagine if I did that?
Right.
They say I deceptively edit, by the way. I don't know. They never give you an example. What is that? What is Bob Woodward doing if not deceptive editing? He's taking an anonymous source who's relaying a quote from somebody else and then putting that in quotes. If I did that, I'd be sued into oblivion.
Right.
And none of this even matters anymore. You know, we're getting to the point now in contemporary society where the left and the right, nobody cares. Facts don't matter. All that matters is that, you know, my enemy is bad, therefore I can lie about him. And that concerns me when the right does it. It's very troubling, and it's psychological, it's philosophical. I don't know how it can get much worse, but I guess we're headed towards worse.
No, but you're right. I mean, these institutions, you know, the paper of record, the New York Times, that rag a few avenues away, you know, they build off of their reputation from old, this old, you know, legacy that they have in order to justify the nonsense that they put out today, you know, which is hardly credible. I mean, if you want to use their own words against them, I mean, you're suing the New York Times.
Yes.
How is that going?
You know, it's fascinating. Thank you for bringing that up. We're going to start suing the crap out of these institutions when we have an actual defamation claim. I don't like to sue people. I've been sued many times. We've won every single lawsuit at Project Veritas. There's one case from 12 years ago that I personally settled. It was over invasion of privacy in California. They'd like to use that against me. The West Point President Project Veritas, it was just me personally. I recorded a guy in California without his permission. And I decided I'm never settling another lawsuit, Gavin. And we never have. And we've won, including at a federal jury trial. So I sued the New York Times for defamation a couple months ago. And already in the motion, in these motions, you put these guys under oath. Already in the original article, the reporter said, Veritas disinformation campaign, experts say. They interview some nobody. This was from Stanford, not to be confused with Stanford University. No, they interviewed just some researcher from Stanford. They called themselves Stanford, I guess, so they would be confused with Stanford University.
Wow.
And then that person said, well, Veritas is probably a disinformation campaign. And then the New York Times ran that quote and said, well, experts say it's disinformation. And then what happened is USA Today cross-cited the New York Times article, and then Facebook uses USA Today as their fact checker. And before you know it, Facebook takes down our video on ballot harvesting in Minnesota. The word probably has been omitted through a game of telephone. Right. I mean, this makes Orwell look like the Cub Scouts.
It's all circular. It's all circular. They're citing themselves. Yep.
So I say to my general counsel, what are we going to do? Well, New York Times messed up in the article, got some facts wrong. They said that we were deceptive. They said that we rely solely on anonymous sources. Gavin, this is crazy. Most of our things are, you could see the face.
You could see the face, exactly.
So we sued them for defamation.
While they're eating a salad or something, of course. You always have them in
eating,
like restaurants.
They're in a restaurant. These are Somalis in Minneapolis. You could see the faces. In one scene, you could actually see them exchanging money in exchange for a ballot. There's nothing anonymous.
Well, where
about
are these
that.
District attorneys? Where is the aspiring, you know, district attorney who's looking to make his bones and uncover some corruption? I mean, you're giving them cases on silver platters, and no one seems to want to run with it. Instead, they're much more worried about shutting you down and shutting voices like you down, rather than taking the evidence and the case that you've essentially built for them and, you know, actually making some prosecutions.
The lack of equality before the law is deeply troubling, and the prosecutorial discretion in Minnesota, Keith Ellison's the attorney general. There's a state law in Minnesota that says you can't have more than three ballots. The guy in the car clearly had dozens of ballots. Facts no longer matter.
Right.
Now, going back to the defamation lawsuit, in the article, she said they rely solely on anonymous sources. And then when we got her under oath, the reporter's name, I'm blanking on names today. The reporter who wrote this New York Times article, Maggie Astor, New York Times columnist, said under oath, she changed the word solely to many. So when we get these reporters under oath, they change their story. It's already a correction, or as we call it, a retracto. It's already a correction. So now the beautiful thing is, then you get into discovery, you get into depositions. Right. So I've decided we got to start suing these people. It's going to cost us millions of dollars to do it, but we have no choice. It must be done.
No, but that's an avenue that many people haven't really explored. You're doing great work on the investigative side, but the litigation battles need to be waged so you can actually set new precedent. You can open up these files through discovery process. You can, you know, drop subpoenas. You could do all this stuff. And you get to the bottom of it, because they're going to continue to act and operate in such an unethical manner because they fear no repercussions, because they know no one's going to go through the time and money that's required to actually bring them to court. And many times you would win. The law is on your side. It just takes a lot of money and effort to get to that point. So, I mean, this is the first of many. Hopefully you can set, you know, a new New York Times v. Sullivan type of case, you know, New York Times v. Project Veritas. That's a new standard for defamation. This will put them on their toes and they can't just start crushing people's reputations.
Well, it's the hypocrisy, because they're suing Fox News for $2.7 billion. This is Dominion. And I heard Ben Smith at New York Times say, this is great. Usually I don't believe in plaintiff cases against media. Usually, but in this case, I do. No. The hypocrisy, it's almost like they like hypocrisy. There's no rules. There's no standard. We are opposed to defamation lawsuits, except in this one against Fox News.
Right.
And you have to prove actual malice in a defamation.
Yeah, that means for you, you're a public figure.
You have to prove that's going back to the 70s Supreme Court case law. You have to prove the person knew they were lying about you when they did that. And, you know, there's a quote by one of my favorite authors, Chesterton, who says, the thing about getting into hot water is it keeps you clean. What do you mean? I've been deposed over a dozen times. Right. And in a deposition, any time you mention the word New York Times, they get all my emails. They put me under oath for 12 hours. We've been through that baptism by fire, and we keep our we run our organization very clean and ethical. These people, can you imagine if you opened up their emails, their text messages, their Signal messages, their Telegram?
Oh, the Slack channels. Forget
Slack,
it. Ugh.
The things that they're saying, you know, they've never been held accountable in their lives.
Right.
And I think the conservative are just as guilty as the liberals, because I think, and I've said this repeatedly, I think the conservatives almost want that adulation from the New York Times. Yeah. They want their book reviewed on the New York Times bestseller list.
The respect.
And they'll never say it. But when Rush Limbaugh, I posted a clip this week from Rush interviewing me from 6 or 7 years ago, the first question Rush Limbaugh asked me on his air was, James, do you ever find that people on the right don't necessarily support you, or you're making it hard for us, James? And I really believe that the problem on the right is that people on the right kind of secretly wish to be liked and praised by these institutions. And they'll never tell you this, but I think it's the case.
Oh, you go to DC, they all want to go to the cocktail parties. They all want to be respected. They all want their byline in the New York Times, the Washington Post. I mean, there's this antiquated sort of institutional respect that they're seeking, but these institutions are broken. They're corrupt. They're broken. They're meaningless. And if you could just make a name for yourself doing honest journalism, which PV is doing, or doing whatever it is you're doing separately, whether it's in media, Rush did that. He built an empire. Mm-hmm. He didn't need them. He built it on his own. We're seeing the rise of alternative media. That's really where the new found fame and respect is coming from. It's not from these broken institutions. Well, once you cross that line, everything seems easier when you don't care.
Well, they have tremendous power. Like the Washington Post was purchased by Bezos for, what was it, $200 million?
Yeah.
And Bezos said in a Medium column that this was the – I don't remember the words he used, but he said this is the crowning achievement of my life. This is a guy who built a whatever $2 trillion company and changed the whole world of commerce. And he's saying the Washington Post, this woke clickbait rag that was, you know, not bankrupt but barely returned a profit. And he turned that into a digital model that catered to a left-leaning audience, as did the New York Times, the dark days of 2010 – These publications did not have a prosperous future. Yeah. And Bezos is saying the proudest achievement, one of the proudest achievements of his life, is his ownership of the WAPO. And I think that he's recognizing something, that these institutions have more power than even we give them credit. We like to say, oh, they don't matter. Yeah. And I know that you believe that. But they do matter because the tech companies are partnered with them.
Propping them up.
And prefer their content and their articles. And when Facebook, and this actually happened to us, Facebook sent a notification to 50 million people, 50 million, in October. This was the video in Minnesota where the Somalis are saying, we don't care, illegal, we buy boats. I mean, this is crazy. This is one of the hard – this story we did in Minneapolis was the proudest – I was more proud of the story than any story we ever did. It took us 6 months to do. We worked with sources who feared for their lives.
James, there's no evidence of voter fraud.
Well, these Somalis – risk their lives to blow the whistle on other Somalis in their own community in Minneapolis in those housing projects. And Facebook sent out a notification to 50 million people with you know, that thing where they blur the video and say it's false information, based upon a USA Today article, probably written by, you know, some 24-year-old nobody, cross-citing a New York Times article, which defamed us, quoting a some institution called Stanford, not to be confused with Stanford University, from a guy who said it's probably disinformation. This is not Orwell anymore. Right. This is a Kafkaesque nightmare. This is insanity.
Well, there's no objective standards. I mean, they create their own standards as they go to suit whatever narrative they're trying to push. And you brought up a great point with big tech in bed with this old legacy, big media, because really, if you look at the numbers, if you go on YouTube, you go on these other websites, you know, all the alternative sources of commentary or news are blowing up. They'll get all the views, they'll get all the likes. And then these legacy outlets, yes, they have the power, they have this sort of, they're being propped up, but they're not getting the numbers that they used to have. And now what are they doing to you guys? They're censoring you. So what happened? They took both your personal account and the Project Veritas organizational account off Twitter.
Right.
And they made you delete tweets. You did like an A-B test sort of thing. What happened?
Yeah. This is a very nuanced thing that occurred. Our reporter, Christian Hartsock, confronted the vice president of Facebook on a street outside of his house. And on the lamppost was the number of his house on the lamppost. So we didn't blur the number. It was in an overlook. Well, traditionally in television reporting, they do this all the time and don't blur the numbers. So we didn't do it. And then Twitter said, you got to take this video down. And I thought for a second, huh? Well, you still have the video up of Drew Griffith from CNN confronting the lady outside of her home in Florida. And she wasn't the vice president of Facebook. She was just a private citizen.
Right.
You didn't blur her number on the lamppost.
A nobody.
She's a nobody. And that tweet's still standing. So I found it to be a double standard. So I said, I talked to Eric Spracklin, our chief of staff. I said, well, Eric, how about we appeal the decision on the PV account? And then on my personal account, I won't appeal it. When we appealed the decision, Twitter said, all right, you got a few weeks. It's going to go through the appeal. Twitter got contacted by the New York Times, CNN, all these big media saying, are you suspending James's account? And that's when Twitter changed their minds and permanently suspended us. The whole appeal process was a joke. They never, it was not even a real process. Once they got contacted by those reporters, they banned Project Veritas permanently and they reinstated my account personally. YouTube, we almost have 1 million subscribers on YouTube. YouTube gave us one strike. They said, this is your first strike. I said, why don't you give a strike to CNN, who that's called a doorstop in television news.
Very common.
Fox 5, New York City does it all the time. Yeah. They did it to me. The Washington Post did
What's the number going to tell you? I mean, you don't know the street. You don't know the city. You don't know the town. It was like an 11 on a
post. Yeah, it's just a number on a lamppost. And Google Street View, you can see it's public information. These are public proceedings.
Right.
So listen, we're entering a brave new world. I think people increasingly want us to stop complaining about the double standards and want us to start
Why don't you sue Twitter? I mean, isn't this not violating Section 230? They are editorializing. Why don't you sue them and challenge their ability to take advantage of 230 protections?
There's no theory under the law that allows us to have a case. And Harmeet Dhillon has spoke extensively about this. There's no legal theory that can get us past the motion to dismiss, as far as
I'm
aware.
Which is the big barrier.
That's when you can depose them under oath and you can do all types of things. But until we get past a motion to dismiss in federal court, I just can't find a legal theory under the law. We're looking into some things I can't disclose on the air because it's attorney-client privilege. But we're not there yet. We don't know how to I think they should just be honest. And for example, and we're announcing some big news this week, another big whistleblower tape inside a massive tech company. It's very exciting. I just want these CEOs or COOs of these tech companies to basically go up and say, listen, we're trying to elect Democrats. This is what we want to do. I'd be happy with that. I'd be happy if they opened up their algorithms and code and here's how we do it. We want to elect Democrats. We want to promote these policies. I think that's what we're headed towards, and that's what I seek to do. That's what I seek to expose. Tim Pool told me this week, well, they have so much cognitive dissonance that they'll never admit this.
It's kind of true.
But I think a substantial minority of them will admit it if we get them undercover.
Well, there's a lot of psychology going on here because obviously what they're doing, how they're engaging the public, how they're engaging people like you is they have to dehumanize you. They have to dehumanize people that are seeking alternative information and, you know, the full story. And that gives them the cover to act in these unethical, immoral ways because they feel like they're actually doing a good thing. So I think Tim Pool is 100% correct there.
Yeah, I think journalism, I believe the solution is the truth. And I get into arguments with people all the time who say nothing matters anymore. And people say nothing matters anymore. Okay, well, I guess we're headed towards a violent civil conflict. But until then, I think the truth does matter. I think investigative reporting traditionally, has been about finding the parameters or finding the things that we can all agree on that are wrong. It's creating what Ida Tarbell coined as righteous indignation, which was the title of Andrew Breitbart's book. Right. That's the idea of where do we define the boundaries of bad behavior? And you expose these things intending to shock people. Increasingly, it's harder and harder to shock
people. They're desensitized.
And the Overton window,
shifted.
That's the range of ideas that you're allowed to discuss, is completely shifted. The impeachment trial of Trump, it's partisan. It's a trial. Are we headed in a world where our municipal, our state, our federal trials are you are voted guilty or innocent based upon whether we like the person's political views? Is that where we're headed?
I mean, it's a popularity contest.
If they like your haircut or not? I mean, that's where we're headed. Right. And I think the only way to prevent us from heading there is to open people through a great awakening by opening people's eyes. I think whistleblowers are the most powerful agents to do this because they have skin in the game. That is to say, they're going to lose their job for the public's right to know. They're almost like heroes, and everyone loves a hero. And they're showing people what's happening inside of Pinterest or Twitter or Google or Salesforce or Fox News or CNN. They're blowing the whistle. And I think that's sort of a universally,
They're the little guy. The little guy, David versus Goliath. It's very hard to demonize them. And that's what I think the legacy institutions are having trouble with, because they'll demonize you as incredible and, you deceptively edit or whatever. But how do they demonize the postal worker in what, Pennsylvania?
Well, they tried.
They tried.
That was a crazy story that Richard Hopkins, the whistleblower, UPS worker, said he overheard his supervisor backdating a ballot. They sent two federal agents to interrogate him for 4 hours. And the guys were, thank God Richard recorded that meeting. Right. And the guys said, we're trying to scare you and change your story because Lindsey Graham is talking about this. They said, we can't have that. We have to harness this storm. It's a scene out of a dystopian novel.
Yep.
It's like the O'Brien scene. It's just like the O'Brien. 2 + 2, repeat after me, 2 + 2 = 5. And the guy goes, well, I have 2 + 2 = 4. And the tyrant says, you will tell me that 2 + 2 = 5 or I will torture you. Richard Hopkins, the mailman, is being interrogated by these agents who then leak to the Washington Post that he recanted his statement. Hopkins is saying, I didn't recant anything. I recorded the whole meeting. This is
smart man.
Thank God he did that. Yeah. Thank God he did that. But the Washington Post has so much power that GoFundMe took his page down. He had raised $130,000 on GoFundMe. Where do you draw that line?
Right.
I mean, so I think the solution to the problems that we're hearing about here on this podcast is to create an army of citizen whistleblowers. And the army grows and grows and grows because they can stop one or two men, but they can't stop an army of these.
Is that going to be under the umbrella of PV? Or you just want that as a broader movement? I mean, how do you organize that? How do you build that out?
Whatever I can do to help. If PV is helpful to create that movement, that's our core mission right now, is to be catalysts for citizens. Whereas in the past, we'd, you know, infiltrate. But Gunter Wallraff, that legendary German undercover guy in the 1970s, you know, one of the things that he wrote in his autobiography is he said, I wish there was a dozen of me.
Right.
It's very hard to scale undercover work. It's very expensive. It's very cumbersome. It's hard to not to run afoul of laws when you're sort of going to do this. So I think we can – right now we have so many of these whistleblowers in place. We have informants everywhere. Right. We have informants inside federal agencies.
I mean, you probably have tons of projects that have been building for years. I mean, you're basically running an intelligence operation essentially.
To some respect, we have informants everywhere. I would say the distinction between us and an intel agency is we operate for the public's right to know.
Right.
And that makes all the difference in the world. So yes, we are building this thing and hundreds of people are calling us like a call center.
Right.
And they're saying, I'm a teacher in Kansas and I overheard this thing happen and hey, give me one of those cameras. Or even television news broadcasters are trying to covertly record their bosses.
Well, what's the profile of these individuals? They always went in there. They went into CNN, you know, oh, I'm going to be a reporter. This is my favorite. You know, I love this job. And then they get disillusioned and they see what's happening and then they come to you. Is that generally what we're seeing?
Yeah, they
or what you're seeing?
They felt betrayed by their institution. They're somewhat naive.
Right.
They're like me when I got started with the Acorn Story. It was like Mr. Smith goes to Washington. But bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, but you slowly become disillusioned. You feel like your employer betrayed your ideal of what the employer ought to do, like CNN. And the younger you are, the more naive you are. Some of the older folks just do it for the paycheck. Right. We spoke to a guy, Patrick Davis at CNN, who is so cynical.
Right.
And he was bemoaning CNN could be so much better than we actually are. But he couldn't do anything because he's a mortgage and kids.
Right.
And most whistleblowers in the 1980s and 90s, most of them regret what they did. So like Jeffrey Wigand, that was the famous tobacco whistleblower that was subject of a movie called The Insider. You know, it's different now because you have the internet. Mm. And back in the day, you had CBS, ABC, and NBC, and now you have the internet. But
it seems more controlled than it was then, even though they had, what, 4 major networks now, or supposedly, you know, it's the internet, the free market. I mean, it seems like it's even more controlled than it was in 1990.
I think there's little pockets of niche audiences now, whereas you had Cronkite and you had Jennings and you had, you know, NBC News. But now you just have so many little audiences. And what I worry about, again, conservatives, go to Parler. But I respect what Parler is doing, and it got banned, and I guess it's been reinstated
now. I can't keep up with them. They're up, they're down, they're left, they're right. I think they're down again.
But again, I don't want to just preach to the choir.
Right.
Our mission should be to get the New York Times to talk about what we're doing. Because if it's not in the Washington Post or the Associated Press, how are you moving the needle?
Parler's an ideological ghetto. It's like a giant, you know, it's everyone's preaching, like you said, to the choir. Everyone already agrees with you. You're not reaching any new audiences. But I know people from my personal life who have seen some of your work and have been, you know, it got them down the path to, you know, quote unquote, being red-pilled. And they see the corruption. They see the illegality and the criminality. And that leads them down the path that wakes them up. But you'll never see that if you're just talking to people who are already on the same page. That's kind of the problem with Parler.
That's the problem I have with some of the people in my comment section who goes, why are you on Twitter? What do you mean, why am I on? I'm on all the things. I want to be on Twitter. I want to be on Parler. I want to be on Rumble. I want to be on BitChute. Put me everywhere. But there's this weird mentality, again, amongst people on the right where they want to go into a ghetto, a conservative ghetto, and preach to each other. Please help me understand how that makes any damn difference. So don't tell me get off Twitter. You should be hoping that we are on Twitter as long as we're allowed to be. And if they do ban us on Twitter, what we're going to do is distribution by proxy. This will send 30-second clips of the federal judge taking the bribe or whatever this story is. And we'll say, hey, every one of you, please post this to your Twitter account. That's what we need to do. But for as long as I've done this, I just feel like conservatives are so bad at it's almost like they're very responsive. They sort of sit on their hands under their ass, and they just wait for the media to be biased. You have, like Andrew used to say, like, you know, Breitbart used to tell me, like, it's like a performance art. You have to get the media to react to you. That's the essence of guerrilla warfare. You get them to react to what you're doing. That's, you need to be the proximate mover of things. And when you're the proximate mover, when you're making the change and you get them to react, that's the liability.
That's what Trump did.
That's
what Trump did. He mastered that.
And they told him he couldn't do it. They're like, oh, you need to spend all this money on advertising. I'll win on earned media.
It's all earned media. That's everything. I mean, look, you broke 1 million followers. You didn't have a blue check. I mean, I think they took it away from you now.
They took 100,000 away, 100, so now we're at 900,000.
All right, you'll get back there. I'm sure. But it just goes to show that you went out there, you're making – you know, you're doing what you're doing and it's building the following. You don't have to get their approvals. You don't have to, you know, work in this false dichotomy that they've set up for everyone else. I mean, that's a path forward for many.
Well, it's not even for me. I mean, people are always saying, oh, I don't care what they think. And I said this to Tim Pool this week. There's a little sliver of me that always did care what they think about me. But the moment you let that go and you just focus on truth and you know, really just focus on what's right is the moment you're actually free to do the right thing. And that's a very important psychological Rubicon that I had to cross. I did it recently in the last few years when I was at that conference with Dean Baquet of the New York Times and I tried to talk to him.
He's great. When he cackles on the street, when you guys approach him, when you have the undercover.
He laughed like so.
Maniacally.
You got to watch this video. We confronted Dean Baquet in Los Angeles. He's living in Los Angeles, not New York City.
I was going to say, because it didn't look like New York from the video. And I said, what is he doing in L.A.?
He has a son in L.A. and he moved out there and he has a house in Los Angeles. He does not live in New York City currently. So we found him on Larchmont Avenue as he's taking a stroll. And we talk to him and he just makes this maniacal laugh. It's as if a consultant paid him money. What to do if you're confronted by Project Vera? I don't know how much money the consultant
paid him. That's the worst consultant because he looked guilty as sin.
He laughed. It was the fakest, loudest. It was almost like they dubbed in laughter into the scene.
Right.
But that's actually him laughing maniacally.
Through his mask.
Why did they – we asked Dean Baquet, executive editor of the New York Times, why did your lawyers cite Wikipedia in the response motions? And we put the microphone. And he laughs like a hyena and says, you guys are ridiculous. Project Veritas is ridiculous. But no, we're not the ones who cite Wikipedia in our lawsuit.
He should be embarrassed. He should be the biggest paper in the country has lawyers citing Wikipedia. I mean, that's something you learn in school not to cite.
Literally in the footnotes of the response to our defamation lawsuit. That's why this litigation is so great, because – it forces them to do – it's forced errors.
Right.
They cite Wikipedia and I get to make videos about it, which get 1 million views, further exposing
the litigation is the guard watching the guardsman. I think you said that on a recent video. I don't remember the Latin. You don't remember the Latin. But is that not what litigation is? I mean, you have to hold their feet to the fire. We have a government with checks and balances, you know, the three branches. Well, who's checking the fourth estate? Who's checking the journalist class, the media? Who?
The People's Defamation Fund. This is a good idea. I'm very busy. Maybe I'll have to do it. But if someone just had a $50 million fund and just started suing media outlets who defamed innocent people, that's what we need to do.
I will be the first applicant because there's some nasty stories about me on the internet. So I will be first in line for that.
You probably have a few cases yourself.
I probably do, yeah. Now, and I know that if it ever got to court, I would win. But the hurdle.
The money. It's the money. It's the money.
The motions.
Listen,
everything.
I've been through this. People don't even maybe they do understand how difficult it was. I had to go all the way to a federal jury trial. It took 4 years. I was in a room with probably six lawyers deposing me. And if you haven't ever been deposed?
Not yet.
Okay. You're under oath for anywhere from 8 to 12 hours. They have binders of all of your emails. Binders filled with women. No. Binders of your emails. Binders. Like just, and they just exhibit after exhibit. What did you mean? And you get really, people get really scared and you're on, I'm in a deposition. No, I don't. I love it. I enjoy it.
Well, you serve people in your
depositions. No, I like it. I serve them in my debt. Lawyers aren't used to dealing with Project Veritas. So I actually enjoy the process of being deposed because I've got nothing to hide. But the People's Defamation Fund, if these donors, these Republican donors, what they ought to do.
Instead of the Federalist Society.
Well, I think the FedSoc does good work. They appoint the judges. But let's get $50 million and start suing media outlets who defame people.
Get cases in front of those judges that you work to appoint.
The federal judges. Now, in our case in New York Supreme Court, for those of you who are not from New York, it just call it Supreme Court.
But it's not the highest court.
It's not the highest court. Yeah. You just call it that. In White Plains, in this defamation lawsuit against the New York Times, I've had two judges recuse themselves from my case. Question is, why? Well, maybe it's because these judges, they know that we have such a good case. Right. They don't want to be holding the hot potato. Right. They don't want to be accountable for when we do win the motion to dismiss. And all these people are like, why did you let that happen?
Right.
Well, they let it happen because it's justice.
Right.
They let it happen because it's the right thing to do.
Well, there was this one judge in New York who, I don't know what kind of mental gymnastics she had to do to rule that, you know, the BLM banner outside of the Trump building was okay, but they couldn't do a pro-Trump banner.
I'd love
as well.
To see those mental gymnastics.
Right. But they'll find someone shameless. Like, you'll have the people recusing themselves from your case, but they will find a shameless judge who will do whatever they can to figure out a way to shut your case down, prevent it from getting it dismissed.
Recusals because the judges don't want to have to endure doing the mental gymnastics that could eventually be used against them, because you can impeach judges. You can file, you know, there are various recourses in the law.
And that few people take advantage of.
That few people have the willpower, if it's not will, it's endurance. And the endurance to go through a trial and put your company. I had to put Project Veritas's entire reputation on the line. Can you imagine if I lost one of those lawsuits, Gavin?
Well, look at what they do for that one case before you really even got big in California. Still bring it up.
And CNN and New York Times settled lawsuits. Oh, they settled against the Covington.
Sandman.
Nobody cares. I settled one lawsuit 12 years ago. I covertly recorded an Acorn guy, Juan Carlos Vera, and he didn't give me permission to record him. That was the issue in that case. Right.
Then if it was in New York, it'd be fine.
California,
two-party consent.
632 of the California Penal Code says that I need your permission if I'm recording you. So we argued in federal court, well, but it was a public area and it was sort of a lobby and the door was open. But I didn't have any money. I didn't have the million plus to litigate this. So I had to settle. It was a nuisance. Personally, James O'Keefe settled. A nuisance settlement. They still use it against me.
Right. It wasn't a matter of substance. It was a matter of resources. But they won't bring up that nuance.
This will be for the rest of my life. The first sentence on my Wikipedia page will say James O'Keefe, who settled a lawsuit. And I remember talking to Andrew Breitbart about it. He said, James, it's not fair, but you have to be a saint. You have to be beyond reproach. And it's impossible for – I'm not Superman. Right. It's impossible for any human to be that perfect. So what most people do, unless you're a masochist, is you quit, you give up, you focus on your kids and your family, and you go do something different.
But so you're a masochist.
Yes. That's a good question.
Yes.
Maybe I am a masochist.
That's the answer.
Or you believe so
That's
much.
That's the clip right there. We're going to open with that.
You already made your TikTok. You're done. Just call it a day. Or you believe so much in what you're doing, or you put so much value on the journey or the quest to get to the destination that it outweighs the pain that you endure. Because there are moments that are profound. Winning in that federal court in North Carolina against these legions of lawyers by the Hillary campaign and other campaigns. Winning that lawsuit, the federal judge striking that gavel and walking out of that courtroom having won was one of the most beautiful moments of my life.
And you're building up armor because people know that you're willing to fight. You're willing to take it to them, and you're not willing.
We don't bluff.
You don't bluff.
We don't bluff.
So it's like, you know, you're kind of like a, you know, you're like a poker player. So people know your MO now. So it's giving you sort of a shield. But if you can take that through a fund and weaponize it, I mean, you could change the whole media landscape because now everything they do, every article they put out, if they're going to write, oh, you know, James O'Keefe or X person, they're going to be like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
People's defamation fund.
But it's important people understand, and maybe they do, maybe they don't, just how the reason why people don't do it. It's the willpower. It's the money. It takes sort of talent for a team of people to go through that trial. And again, the one of the most beautiful moments of my life was that it was the Teeter case in North Carolina. We won. The federal judge struck the gavel. Right before the federal judge struck that gavel, the jury came out. You know, this is the trial, like just like you see in the movies, although they don't allow cameras in federal courtrooms. Mm. And the jury comes out, and the jury is about to issue a verdict. And the judge, Judge Reitinger, gavels on a Rule 50 and says, I'm going to issue a directed verdict, meaning there's no possible way that any reasonable person could possibly think that O'Keefe is guilty in this case. It's never been issued before by this judge. Judge has been on the bench for 13 years. And the judge looks over at the plaintiff. And, you know, these are a bunch of, again, high-priced lawyers. I've got like one or two. They've got like six, an army of lawyers. I don't know how she affords all of them. That's another story. And says, this is ridiculous. I'm paraphrasing him. He goes, this is absurd. If Mike Wallace were sued, people would laugh. Mm. I had to take it all the way to a jury verdict to get there. If I was the New York Times, never would have got that far.
Well, that's why it's so important to defame you. And that's why, you know, you go to your Wikipedia page and you're some far right militant. I mean, if you read what they write about you, which is kind of, you know, hilarious because really what you're doing, I mean, if in any other period in time, it would have looked at, oh, he's just a journalist. I mean, there's nothing necessarily political about putting out what Zuckerberg said on an internal call. How is that political? You don't add, you know, necessarily commentary to it. You just say, look, these are his rules. This is his policy. What do you think? And they claim that makes you essentially like a far rightist.
I mean, it's beyond absurd. And it goes back to your idea of newspeak or doublethink. Everyone just needs to reread 1984. Yeah. I'm not sure everyone has, but this idea of doublethink that you can, and you can't talk about doublethink because in talking about it, you're admitting that you are tampering with reality.
I mean, Orwell was a genius. I mean, we're kind of living in this quasi world between 84 and Brave New World. I mean, you have people from, you know, what was that drug in Brave New World that they were all taking the whatever that they just kind of put them, made them idle and made them forget everything. And then you have the 1984 where it's much more aggressive. You have the inner party, the outer party, and these journalists are really just members of the outer party, and they're just trying to control the proles. I mean, that's really what it is. I mean, there's an inner core, you know, with Jeffrey Zucker and people like that who are basically, you know, on the morning calls, calling the shots, directing things. They know what they're doing. Then there are the people in the, you know, the outer party that believe him, and then there's the proles that dig it up. I mean, it's basically right out of 84.
Yes. And we as reporters, investigative reporters, try to be in our mission statement, it says the custodians of the public's conscience. We test and affirm what is and what is not outrageous to people. In that clip you just mentioned, Zuckerberg is privately saying, I think that the vaccine, the coronavirus vaccine, messes up your DNA. He says this. Mm. Now, his policy says that your content will be banned if you say this.
Right.
You can't have a more – it's a logical contradiction. It's clear as crystal. We got no comment from Andy Stone at Facebook. It's remarkable. They don't feel the need to comply.
They're not worried about anything. They are a power into themselves. They're more powerful than many, you know, sovereign states. So what do they care about, you know, your questions and all that? And that's the problem, is that, you know, you have a journalist class that's so afraid of them, that's so beholden to them, and they're not willing to actually question these guys. Many of them are either in their pocket directly or indirectly. I mean, how can you actually have a free society if the free press is not operating as they should?
You mentioned Brave New World. There's a movie, I think it's called Oblivion by Tom Cruise. I don't know if you've seen that one. And Tom Cruise is cloned. Have you seen this movie, Gavin?
I don't believe so.
About 5 years ago. And the end of the movie, hopefully I'm not spoiling it for you all.
I'll just spoil it.
I'm just going to go ahead and do that. Tom Cruise, there's many Tom Cruises, and he's fighting in, you know, in a future Earth. And you realize that this whole thing, the cloning of this soldier, is done not by humans, but by an AI machine. And he finds where the genesis of what he is, and he goes into outer space, and he confronts this like this red dot in Space Odyssey. That's it. It's just an AI bot controlling everything. And I feel like that's where we're headed. Like I thought the other day, well, my army of proxies will put out these little bits, these clips on their Twitters, but the AI bot will one day find the words that we're using and censor all of it because the proxy army will do it. But
that's terrifying. A woke AI that's going to run society. That is the next 1984.
I'm just trying to envision, because I don't think Upton Sinclair and Gunter Walworf and Walter Cronkite and Ida Tarbell and Lincoln Stevens and these muckrakers, most of them were socialists. That's the irony. They're all socialists exposing.
Well, the left
facts.
Now is corporatist. I mean, they would be horrified by what the left is today.
I think so.
Pro corporations, pro big entities, big business.
Well,
Teddy Roosevelt
and Stevens had a thing. What's his name? Upton Sinclair and Teddy Roosevelt, you know, had a pissing match. Mm-hmm. But it's like Teddy Roosevelt like in the busting of the trusts.
Right.
But I try to envision that this is very terrifying, the mm-hmm. world that we're entering. But there's one thing that can stand up to the tyranny. It's a hero, yeah. right? It's the idea of what Daniel Boorstin talks about, the former Librarian of Congress, in his book, The Image. He talks about the hero, the honest cop, the honest fireman, Sully Sullenberger, the guy that landed the plane in the Hudson River.
Yes, great mustache.
These are heroes, and they tell stories about their lives. Mm-hmm. So maybe the idea of a hero or a citizen muckraker can transcend the AI, the terrifying artificial intelligence thing that is occurring in our society, where our reality is controlled by two or three institutions.
It's insane. I mean, I have the white pill that says in 100 years they're going to look back at this time and all of this will be uncovered. It'll all be public record, and you know, people that try to expose it will be put up as heroes, and the institutions, these corrupt institutions.
Do you think that'll happen?
I think so. I think when these special interests are gone and there's no institutional forces trying to push this false narrative, because, you know, no one cares what happened necessarily 300 years ago. I mean, you know, no one cares about the corruption in the 1600s. No one's alive anymore.
Right.
So eventually the truth has to come out. It just takes a matter of time. Maybe it'll take longer, but whatever. I think eventually it'll be exposed. The problem is we forget the past so easily. We forget the Upton Sinclairs. We forget, you know, what happened just a mere 100 years ago, and now we're reliving it. We have the big trusts. We have the big monopolies. They're doing things way worse than Standard Oil or whoever. But no one cares anymore. It doesn't matter because they've just forgotten it all, and that's the problem.
But there's an increasing number of people that realize that, well, they remember what we did 10,000 years from now. Well, they remember that we were alive. Well, they think about it. What do you remember from 10,000 years ago? Not much. Or even 1,000 or 2,000. So actually, that's a reason why whistleblowers are saying, you know what? I'm going to be ashes one day. Maybe I better make a difference in other people's lives and provide hope to people. And I mark my words, as I sit here today, Veritas will break as many as 25 whistleblower stories this year, maybe even 50.
I think you broke one since you sat down. It's actually crazy. I think we had three releases, and we have to probably get to those.
Whistleblower this week in a big tech, and every time we do one, 10 more come out, and they say, I'm only going to be alive for so long on this earth. There are things more important than my mortgage and, you know, whatever.
Well, they have to live for a higher purpose. And that's the problem. A lot of people are just living in the now.
This is changing.
That's changing. Hopefully for the better.
No, this, I can tell you right now, it's changing. When I have TV anchors coming to me, hosts, like on air TV anchors, secretly recording their corporate bosses and saying, people who are violating their own non-disclosure agreements. Mm. And sending us tape in droves.
Heroes, real heroes. Personal loss to bring, you know, truth to power.
So perhaps heroism can defeat tyranny, or heroism can defeat these tech monopolies.
I think a lot of them are paper tigers, and if you just have people with moral courage, you know, to go after them, they do fall like a house of cards. I mean, hopefully, I mean,
that's
we'll
the
see.
Hypothesis.
We'll see. I mean, we may both end up in the gulag together, so then, you know, we could laugh about it then.
When we go to the gulag, just like I said at the NYRCC event,
yes.
You know, the important thing is when we have the hunger strike, don't break rank. Because in Gulag Archipelago, they everyone's, okay, we're going to do a hunger strike. No one eat anything. And there was one guy who was like, I need a sandwich. And they said that the pain of seeing their colleague betray them was worse than the starvation. So when we go to the gulag and we do the hunger strike and you get hungry, Be strong, my friend.
You said that with a smile. That was the most depressing thing I've ever heard. But I also wanted to talk about, we were talking about changing timelines. I mean, you mentioned the Acorn story. I mean, that was, what, 10 years ago? Mm-hmm. And that led to legislative action with, I believe it was a Democrat-controlled Congress.
The Senate voted 83-7 to defund Acorn.
To defund them.
And they were
that would never happen
controlled.
Today. You could all the stuff you're bringing out about big tech and all these different entities – The country is so divided.
It depends, right? Because Alinsky, Saul Alinsky, and you know, oh, James O'Keefe going to quote Saul Alinsky? Yes, he is.
Everyone should read Alinsky.
We read Saul Alinsky's. I don't believe he was a Satanist. I don't believe he was dogmatic. I don't believe he was a communist.
He was a Machiavelli.
I think he was a tactician. Yeah. And I think a lot of the things he wrote were not unethical. They were just like common sense exposed hypocrisy. And Alinsky said, make them live up to their own book of rules. It was his rule number 4 in his tactics chapter. So with the Acorn story, they were like telling me how to classify underage hookers as dependents on the tax forms. And the recent story we did on PBS, it was Michael Beller, general counsel, one of the counsel PBS, saying that we need to throw Molotov cocktails at Trump's limousine. It was almost like he was doing his own mini insurrection. So we were making them live up to their own book of rules. We cancel the cancel culture people. That's the only path forward.
That's the little hole in the Death Star.
That's
to
the
blow
little
it up.
Hole. Yeah. You got to cancel. So what do they believe in? They believe in cancel culture and great. Find what they're saying and doing that mm-hmm. violates their own rules. Mm. Their whole thing is insurrection. And okay, great. Let's expose them promoting insurrection.
Wow. Because if you accept their frame, beat them with their own frame. You could either reject the frame that they're trying to set, which conservatives should do, or people on the right, or anyone who's just anti-establishment. It could be on the left. Or you take the frame they made and you find the logical inconsistencies and you blow it up. It's like a robot, you know. It's
same thing with the Planned Parenthood. When I got started with Lila, it was Margaret Sanger founded Planned Parenthood, and she said we want to. And this is I'm quoting her.
Yep.
And by the way, I'm going to quote this, and every two words I'm going to say I'm quoting her, so they don't take my words out of context.
Please do.
Quote: they want to exterminate. This is Margaret Sanger talking. Quote: the NEGRO population. That's Margaret Sanger talking. That's what she said. Okay,
so she was a eugenicist, and they still have awards for her.
So if the eugenicists believed in that, and I went in, you know, undercover into Planned Parenthood and documented them saying we agree with that philosophy, they fired Autumn Kersey, the vice president of Planned Parenthood in Idaho, for saying that she really supports what Margaret Sanger was saying. Now this is making them live up to their own concepts of race and sexuality. I wasn't exposing anything about abortion or being immoral or life begins at conception. That's not what we were reporting on. We were reporting on someone within Planned Parenthood saying it's great that what Margaret Sanger was saying about black people. Okay. This is the path forward. This is the, I'm probably giving away too much information here psychologically, but this is how you expose them.
I think it's good. Continue. People would pay for this.
But I've got to go soon. So
yes. Well, this has been fantastic. I wanted just to pass the last words off to you where people can follow you. Obviously, they probably should know, but where they can go to give tips, where they can go to, you know, help you out with the next big story, the next big break, whatever it is you want to end on. And please also tell us how many pimp canes you own.
I think I actually lost the pimp cane.
You lost it. Why is that not framed?
We framed the coat itself, which is a chinchilla. It's shedding. It's an old pimp coat. I don't know what happened to the pimp cane. Still have the pimp hat. And in terms of going, it's the projectveritas.com/brave is the portal where you could, you know, sign up to work for us. We're currently trying to hire a chief operations officer. That's number 2. We're a large organization at this point with a fairly good budget. So I'm looking for a chief operations officer, and I'm going to make a shameless plug for candidates to apply at projectveritas.com/brave. And you can also visit us at veritastips@protonmail.com. Veritas, that's V-E-R-I-T-A-S, tips@protonmail.com. If you're on the inside, or your brother or sister or friend is on the inside of an institution, you can go there and contact us.
Awesome. Well, James, it's been fantastic. Thank you for coming on the Waxcast. Hope to have you back.
Thank you.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.